You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning. My name is Tom Wright. I'm the director of the Center for the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution and a senior fellow in the Project on International Order and Strategy. I am delighted today to be chairing this important discussion on election 2020 and its implications for U.S. foreign policy. Obviously, over the weekend, there's been some rapid developments. There is now a president-elect, Joe Biden, after a pretty tumultuous few days, I think, for everyone, and an election that was pretty close for many days, but now looks like we have a clear winner. So we have a terrific panel this morning to discuss not so much the election, but really looking forward to next year to see what the implications are for U.S. foreign policy, for international order, and to parse maybe some of the nuances of last week and what they may mean, particularly the fact that Trumpism is alive and well, even though the president did not receive a second term and that the Senate could be in the hands of Republicans. We have Eric Edelman, who is the Roger Hertog Distinguished Practitioner in Residence at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Evan Osnos, who is a staff writer at The New Yorker and a non-resident senior fellow at Brookings at the John L. Thornton China Center. Tamara Wittes, who is a senior fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. And Victoria Newland, who is a non-resident senior fellow at the Center for the United States and Europe. All of them have served in very senior positions in government, which I won't go into at the moment, but you can rest assured that they come equipped with decades of experience at the highest levels. And Evan has recently written a book on Joe Biden, which is titled, Evan, the title escapes me at the moment, but it flipped off my screen there. But it's Joe Biden, I think, his life and times and what it means for the 2020 election. So, Evan, let's start with you, if we can. Joe Biden has been around a long time. As we heard repeatedly from Donald Trump, he's been in office or out of office for about 47 years. He has a long track record on U.S. foreign policy. In some ways, he's a very known quantity, but in other ways, he's a bit of an enigma. His views have evolved a bit over time. He is a large team that has these debates about foreign policy that have been sort of obscured a little bit by the Trump show. Many people in Biden world were expecting a repudiation of Donald Trump, an overwhelming victory that would send a message to the world. He has won a clear victory, but it was maybe more close and more marginal than many people anticipated. He may well have a Republican Senate. He, of course, has said that his superpower is working with Republicans, working with people on the other side of the aisle. So as he sort of contemplates the first few days of his transition and the beginning of his term, how do you think he sort of interprets the results of last week, particularly with the view to what it means for his foreign policy and for the future sort of America's global role?
Thanks, Tom. Yeah, and it's great to be with my colleagues up here and with all of you who are tuning in. I think there are, as Tom mentioned, I think there are in some ways elements of Joe Biden's mind, his approach to diplomacy as to domestic policy that we sometimes overlook or haven't really studied in detail until just now. And they can help us anticipate some of the things that I think we're likely to see. I'll talk just for a minute here about what I think we can broadly describe as an era of division at home and abroad. And I think that's important as a defining piece of this, as a way of sort of understanding this period of structural and sustained hostility in the US and in many of its relationships, which will have implications. But before we do that, I just want to talk a minute about President-elect Biden's theory of diplomacy. Because when you talk to him about how he thinks about diplomacy, which is something he cares a great deal about, he will tell you that he draws somewhat of a distinction between the way that it's conventionally practiced. As he said to me at one point, look, sometimes diplomats get tired because I will say to them, I'm not going to go into a room and say what you want me to say exactly as you wrote it here, because his basic view, and he would apply this in Wilmington or in Baghdad or in Beijing, is don't tell another person what their interests are. That's his fundamental idea. They will have a notion of their interests. And as he puts it, you know, in my experience, people are generally not open to being persuaded that their own calculation of their interests is wrong. What you have to do is show them the basic element of recognition that you're hearing them, you're listening with them. You don't have to pretend you agree, but if you begin from the position that you trust their own ability to calculate their interests, you're starting off at an advantage than if you come in and tell them why they're wrong. And I think another piece of this that's meaningful is Joe Biden and Barack Obama actually had a very important thing that bound them together when they were joined together on this ticket. You know, oftentimes presidents and vice presidential tickets are kind of shotgun marriages. In their case, they had this thing that tied them. And it was this basic belief in the possibility of unification, that you could actually unify people, but they use very different tools to do it. In President Obama's case, as we know, he had a kind of transcendent story, his own personal story, and the power of his eloquence, of his political rhetoric, was able to, both at home and abroad, he began this process of trying to restore some element of the American image, of American credibility. And that was his approach. And you saw that in the sort of significance of his speeches and so on. President-elect Biden has a different view. He does not pretend, frankly, that he has that kind of American story that can communicate what the future of the United States is likely to be. What he says is, in fact, I have the relationships, I have these kinds of fundamental person-to-person contacts, and most of all, I believe that if you go back to that first principle, that you acknowledge that somebody else's interests may be legitimate, that's the basis for a meaningful discussion. And I'll just very briefly mention one other thing, which is, it is significant that he knows a lot of these people. I mean, George Mitchell at one point said to me, we used to have foreign leaders, you know, he went in the Senate with Joe Biden for a long time. And he said, we would have foreign leaders come all the time to the Senate. And my job was to go around and introduce these foreign leaders to members of the Senate. So I would say, over here is Senator Kit Bond, and over here is Senator so-and-so. And then these foreign leaders would say, hi, Joe. So there is a certain, they just knew him. And that, at a moment like now, when the United States, frankly, looks unfamiliar in so many ways now, in the nature of its politics, the nature of our divisions, to our friends and opponents abroad, an element of recognizability is a political asset that I think we sometimes discount. I'm going to save specific comments about all of the various specific domains, China, Europe, and elsewhere, because my colleagues, I think, will get us going on that, and we come back to any of them in more specifics during Q&A. So, Tom, back to you, I think.
Thank you, Evan. And tomorrow, you served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for the Middle East, for Near Eastern Affairs in the first term of the Obama administration. You had the opportunity, you know, to work with then Vice President Biden. We'll get into the Middle East part of it later on, I think, in the discussion. But, you know, just to the question on his sort of outlook, you know, how it might have changed following the election of last week, what he's sort of thinking, you know, what do you think he's thinking about the challenges he's facing in the world with still a very, very divided country at home? And is his foreign policy likely to be a little bit different this week, maybe, than it would have appeared just before the election?
Oh, wow. I think that last is a difficult question, but let me try and start with the broader outlook question. I think that one thing we've seen from Joe Biden throughout his career, whether it's in domestic policy, foreign policy, or in politics itself, is an ability to learn and grow and change. This is not his first run for the presidency. And he, you know, across his career, I think, has just gotten better and better and better at what he does. What Evan pointed out about his determination to empathize and to seek out common ground, I think these are elements of practical diplomacy that will serve him very well And, you know, he's got the background to hit the ground running, but the challenge he faces coming in January is how much the ground has shifted since he was in the vice presidency. That's very true in the Middle East, where we've seen historic developments over the last decade, some of which he was in office for, some of which he was not. But it's true across the board. The global geopolitics has changed. Transatlantic partners are in a different place now than they were 4 years ago. And there's a degree of uncertainty in global politics that I think has led a number of our traditional partners to engage in self-help over the course of the Trump administration. And it's not simple to unwind that. So I think his capacity to learn and grow is going to be put to use very, very quickly. But I think that he'll probably root himself in some of the common ground that he's found with partners in the past, whether that is, you know, on the Iranian challenge, on counterterrorism, on strengthening our sort of coalition of democracies across the world, which is something he spoke about a lot during the campaign. But it's hard to see how to put meat on the bones of all of those good intentions without those deep conversations with his foreign interlocutors to hear from them and to find that common ground. So no doubt there's a lot of prep work that's been going on, but he will be reaching out and having a lot of conversations. He'll want to hear it for himself. And, you know, he's not going to be able to put these things on pause while he figures it out.
Thank you. Thank you, Tamar. That's fascinating. Eric, if we could turn to you next. I mean, you have served in very senior positions in the Pentagon and overseas in Republican administrations. What do you think Mitch McConnell and, I guess, the foreign policy-oriented senators are thinking at the moment? I mean, there's I'd say a better than 50-50 chance that they retain control of the Senate following the runoffs in Georgia on January 5th, and we need to wait to see, of course, the results. But if you're looking at it now, you know, there's probably a pretty decent chance they remain in control. So they'll have control basically of the nomination process. They'll have considerable oversight. Obviously, they're necessary for any legislation to pass. And it has been a pretty divided election. We've already seen some senators come out and basically back Donald Trump's theory of the case. So what do you think McConnell and some of the other senators are thinking? And is there sort of a prospect for cooperation between a Biden administration and a Republican-controlled Senate?
Well, thanks, Tom. First, it's great to be here with you and with all my colleagues on here, with whom I have all sorts of unusual ties. I mean, Toria and I think succeeded each other in a variety of positions in government. Tammy's parents were exceedingly kind to me when I was ambassador in Turkey, and Evan's grandparents, you know, lived where in the same neighborhood my grandparents did in Manhattan. So it's a great panel, and I'm thrilled to be part of it. Look, the Republican Party, certainly the Republican Party of Ronald Reagan, has been shattered and is beyond recognition in terms of its approach to national security policy. I think that for those of us who were never Trump Republicans, and I was part of two different groups of that ilk that endorsed Vice President Biden, we had hoped for, as you indicated, a bigger repudiation of Trump and Trumpism, and we didn't get it. I mean, I think Vice President Biden is going to win a pretty solid victory when all the votes are counted. He's likely to have a slightly higher margin than Barack Obama did against Mitt Romney, but it's still not the repudiation of Trumpism that might have served as a helping cleanser of the Republican tendency to in particularly in the Senate, to enable President Trump's worst instincts. And you know, you can see that already in what's happened in the post election period, when a number of Republicans in the Senate have jumped like trained seals to respond to tweets from Donald Jr., et cetera, about defending his father's, you know, totally undemocratic efforts to cast doubt on the results of the election, which I think is really dangerous for our democracy, and benefits only one person, which is Vladimir Putin. Might also benefit Xi Jinping, so might be more than one. What will happen in the Senate? I think Senator McConnell, I think Leader McConnell's instincts remain sort of traditional internationalist, conservative internationalist Republican. He does have a longstanding relationship with Vice President Biden. I think his instinct is going to want to try and be pragmatic to get some things done. And I think, in fact, probably some contacts are already beginning to happen between Vice President Biden's folks and congressional staffers on the Republican side. So I think that's you know, all to the good. But Leader McConnell is going to have a very large challenge, and that is going to be that the election results are likely to have ratified in the minds of a number of people that the problem was not the message, it was the messenger, that this was a you know, repudiation of Trump, but not necessarily of Trumpism, and that therefore hostility to trade agreements, hostility to our alliances, are going to be the ticket to success in 2024, and that Trump lane, I think, is going to be very crowded with a number of candidates, and many of them are going to try and stoke the Trump base and win it over for themselves, and to win Donnie Jr. and President Trump's, imprimatur for their own candidacies by being obstructionist and by opposing everything, by leading the resistance to a Biden administration. So I think McConnell is going to have a tough row to hoe himself. He's going to need some cooperation from the Biden team in helping him manage that. Particularly on, I don't think it's going to be as big an issue in confirmation for cabinet positions, but the sub-cabinet positions, I think, that are open for confirmation are going to be a bigger battleground, and that's going to require some very dexterous cooperation on both sides, which I hope happens, because that will be good for the country.
Thank you, Eric. Toria, you have also served not just in the Obama administration as Assistant Secretary for Europe, but also in several other administrations and both parties as a Foreign Service officer, very senior levels. Picking up where Eric left off, if we are likely to see sort of the continuation of Trumpism in the Republican Party and in the Senate, but you still have some of those internationalist elements there, and you have a President Biden who is sort of naturally inclined to bipartisanship, what do you think sort of the best prospects are to sort of recreate, if not the bipartisan consensus, at least sort of a strong bipartisan view, maybe not shared by everybody in each party, on America's leadership role internationally?
Well, thanks, Tom. First, it's great to be with everybody on this fresh Monday morning and with so many patriots and folks who've served their country so well. Listen, Biden came up along with most of the senior members of the Senate in a period where the fundamental underpinning was that political fights ended at the water's edge. And when you went out into the world, you went out as a unified and ideally a bipartisan front to talk to allies and adversaries alike about the challenges and to represent the United States. I think that will be Biden's instinct to try to reach out, as Eric said, to the McConnells and Burrs and Cornyns and, you know, traditional Republicans of his generation. But I think Eric is not wrong that on the foreign policy and security side, we don't know yet what those who will posture for the Trump voters of 2024, the younger folks, will take from the foreign policy agenda of Trump. I mean, I thought it was pretty interesting that throughout the Trump period, even as some of the more Trumpian Republicans in the Congress supported punishing allies on the trade side, almost nobody joined this caravan of, you know, Trump hostility towards NATO, even Trump hostility towards the EU as an institution or towards allies in general. And over the period of the Trump administration, this America go it alone, America unilateralism did not have popular support. You know, public opinion polling for institutions like NATO and the UN went up over this period. And I think that reflects the fact that the American people never really did buy that it's better for us, cheaper for us to take on issues like China, issues like the new national security challenges from high technologies like artificial intelligence and quantum, et cetera, by ourselves. That first and foremost, if we could do it with allies, that would be better and cheaper and more persuasive for us. But secondarily, that doing it all alone puts all of the burden of things like sanctions on China on the American farmer rather than on a broader coalition, and it stands less of a chance of success. So I think Biden's instinct obviously will try to be to rebuild a traditionalist bipartisan coalition for American leadership. I think there'll be, you know, a demand on the Republican side for a more rigorous approach to some things, China in particular, than they may have seen from the Obama administration. But as Tammy said, I think that's where President-elect Biden has and his team have evolved anyway, that it's time to be far more organized, structured, rigorous, and strong as a democratic community in the way we approach Russia, China, and some of these other challenges from authoritarians who want to change the rules-based system in their favor. So I think he will make a strong effort. I just wanted to underscore a couple of things that Evan said, as somebody you know, who had the honor of traveling with Biden and watching him work as a U.S. diplomat in the Obama administration. Not only does he start from the premise that you can't tell somebody else what their interests are, he starts by trying to understand what the other person on the other side of the table thinks their interests are, and then what their political environment is, where their room to maneuver is, and then to try to call the interlocutor on the other side of the table to their higher angels to try to take some political risks together for a better outcome for both countries or for a larger group of countries. And he's fundamentally extremely optimistic in his approach. So just as he, you know, believes that the nation needs healing, I think he thinks the planet needs healing, and particularly that the democratic community has got to come together in a stronger way to address the many challenges that we have. So I think he will start from that optimistic place. He will do a lot of listening, but I also think that democratic allies need to be ready that he will be quite demanding, because he will not want to address these big challenges that we have alone. And he will want the help of allies and partners in Asia, in Europe, and other parts of the world. So, you know, I think it'll be a much more multilateral approach, but I don't think that he'll be a pushover with allies either.
Tom, can I just pick up on something that both Tammy and Toria just talked about, which I think is really, really important, but I want to kind of put a slightly different gloss on it, which is, you know, Toria was just talking about, you know, rebuilding sort of multilateral approaches. And Tammy was talking about the tendency of some of our partners and allies to engage in self-help. I agree with both those observations. But I think it's important to remember that this actually is, it's bigger than Trump and Biden, right? Because for a lot of allies, they look back at the last 12 years, including the Obama years, and see a pattern of retrenchment and diminished, in their view, U.S. leadership. They look at the vacuum that was created by Obama's arguably underreaction to what happened in Syria. And they wonder whether this is not just a transient phenomenon that Trump represented, but something rather longer lasting. And so the challenge I think Biden's going to face as he attempts to address these issues that Tammy and Toria were talking about is how credibly can he say, look, I'm not Barack Obama. I'm not just the, you know, the second incarnation of Barack Obama. I'm Joe Biden, and I'm bringing a different approach. And it's one in which America is going to be more active than you've seen it be, not just in the last 4 years, but in the last 12 years. And I think that's going to be really his challenge.
Eric, that's a great point. And, you know, I've long thought the key analytical question about a Biden administration is not how is he different to Trump, but how is he different to Obama, just in terms of getting leverage on what it might be like. And I guess Tamara, maybe you could come in next on that. I mean, the way, and you know, we've discussed this before, of course, but the way I try to think about it is, you know, are there sort of key assumptions or orthodoxies from the Obama administration that are sort of different this time out? You know, and I guess, you know, you could address that in the context of the Middle East or more broadly on other issues, but, you know, what do you think those most likely, I guess maybe not shifts, but debates. I mean, what are the debates within the broader sort of foreign policy community around Biden about whether or not there should be a significant departure, either along the lines that Eric was suggesting or something else?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. And this is already such a rich conversation. I'm really enjoying it. I think what you've already heard from this panel about the president-elect's proclivities would suggest that he sees politics as the art of the possible, that he doesn't sort of go in with these lofty, overarching visions the way Obama did. You know, remember Obama's speech, this feels like a century ago, on eliminating nuclear weapons, for example. You know, I think Obama had, partly because of his own personal story, but partly because of the way he approached the world, he thought that he could sketch out these ambitious visions and inspire others to move forward. I think President-elect Biden is going to take a much more down-to-earth approach. Here are the problems we're facing together. How do we work together to make this better than it is? And I think the question that Eric posed of can he really take that down-to-earth approach while simultaneously sending the message that we're back, we're engaged, we're driving events at a moment when, look, you know, the United States, like every other country in the world, is facing a tremendous domestic crisis because of COVID. And that's layered on top of all of the drivers of this desire to pull back from the world that exist in our domestic politics and that affected both Obama and Trump. So he, you know, if he wants to be engaged abroad, he is pushing into a domestic political headwind. And I think that, you know, I think the challenge begins at home with persuading Americans that it is necessary to remain engaged and that actually, as Toria said, that we can get more done more effectively at lower cost and perhaps lower risk working with partners. Now, you know, where do we see the relative bipartisan agreement on which international issues could a Biden administration start out with common ground with Republicans in the Senate, for example? China, clearly, you know, you can look back at the clear unified message from congressional Democrats and congressional Republicans and the Trump administration at last year's Munich Security Conference on China, for example, just across the board. You know, you can see it on Russia, a desire to impose stronger consequences on the Russians and try to constrain their behavior in Europe and elsewhere. And you can see it also on Saudi Arabia. Let's remember that, you know, Obama had his veto of legislation from bipartisan legislation, the JASTA legislation, overridden by Congress at the end of the administration, allowing 9/11 families to pursue remedies in American courts against Saudi Arabia. And we saw votes in Congress to suspend arms sales to Saudi Arabia because of the Yemen war that Trump had to veto. So, you know, if you look at those three areas, I think all of those are areas where if that's where you start, it pushes the United States in a more confrontational direction toward these three actors. And, you know, doing that effectively is going to require international coalitions. But there's also the question of, is that where a Biden administration wants to start? Rather than focusing on, you know, strengthening democracies, working on climate change, addressing the challenge of nuclear proliferation, you know, addressing the global health challenge. You know, these are things that are going to require cooperation, including from Russia and China. So I do think there's an inherent tension between the domestic equation, if you will, and the international equation that's going to be difficult to solve.
I actually see it the opposite way, Tom, if I might. I think if you look at the foreign affairs article that Biden penned a year ago, and you know the few times during the campaign that there have been conversations about national security and foreign policy, because it really didn't figure too much. There is a strong stream of thought that strong at home also requires being strong abroad, and that the two challenges, rebuilding in the United States and building back better, have to work in tandem with restoring U.S. leadership abroad. And the degree to which we can make an infrastructure leap, an innovation leap, a defense leap, you know, past the old rusty technologies to the new security challenges, and use stimulus money to make ourselves stronger, will make us both a better leader globally in terms of how we deal with economic recovery, how we deal with pandemic, but will also put us in a stronger position to lead other allied countries in a unified approach to Russia, to China, will ensure that neither of those countries gets a rout on us in terms of next generation economy, et cetera. So, and then the question becomes, and you see this in the writings of some of Biden's key advisors, how do you convince American kitchen tables that the two issues are linked, that so many of the jobs that they depend on in the heartland are linked to open trade and open borders, not necessarily new trade agreements, but maintaining the freedom of navigation and freedom of markets and not tariffing your friends and all of those kinds of things. But also, how do you ensure that some of this stimulus money that's going into the United States and that Europe is applying is also bringing us better standing in the world, better outcomes, more green, innovative ways of running our countries such that we're stronger vis-a-vis adversaries and not ceding the field to them in the next generation economies and security infrastructure. So I think they see it as linked. It's a tall order to implement that way, because you're going to have to get some, this is where the Congress comes in, you know, is a Republican Congress going to support the kind of investment that Biden's talked about, $80 billion? And are they going to see it as a gift to him, or are they going to see it as part of strengthening the country for everybody and strengthening our leadership role? That's the challenge, I think.
Thanks, Tori. If I could bring Evan back in on precisely that point, and I'll start to weave in some questions from the audience as well, because they're streaming in, and Trudy Rubin of the Philadelphia Inquirer has a question, how will Biden handle China policy, including on trade and technology? And Evan, if you could address that, but if I could also add another China question as well to it, which is the point really Tori is making there, that, you know, getting the domestic agenda through and even getting some of the nominations through will be difficult with a Republican-controlled Senate. One way to do it is to make competition with China more central to the overall foreign policy narrative, right? That you need to have these infrastructure investments to compete with China, and that there's necessary changes to the technology side, that maybe some of the nominees, you know, will sail through more if they're seen as having a liberal sort of version of great power competition. There seems to be an active debate both in Biden world and in Democratic circles on the wisdom of that. Some people embrace it, some people resist it. What's your sense, I guess, of A, the substance of it, having such experience on China and having written a book, of course, on it, but also on the internal politics within Biden world on the China issue?
You know, in some ways, this is the issue that ties together so many of the themes we've been talking about, all of us today, because in you could take just as an example, China is one of the areas in which you see not a departure so much from the Obama approach, but an evolution, often in some cases by some of the same practitioners. And this is partly because of a recognition of the facts on the ground, that things have changed both in the relationship, both in Chinese leadership, and also in America's view at the elite level and at the popular level. And look, I think if you take, if you look back at what Biden wrote, like what President-elect Biden wrote, and then also if you look at what some of his key advisors had been writing in foreign affairs and elsewhere, you begin to get a feel for the ways in which there is a recognition that the fundamental organizing principle of the U.S.-China relationship under the Obama administration is no longer operative in the same way. It's not simply cooperation will lead to a more cooperative China, that it is now a recognition that we're into a phase of, to some degree, obviously a much more contested arrangement. Now, I will say a couple of things specifically. On the U.S. sort of political side, take, for example, just as a data point, that you had a Senate resolution to censor Beijing over its involvement in Hong Kong that passed 100-0. Nothing else in the United States these days could pass 100-0. That creates, from the incoming administration side, a tremendous reservoir of options. They are able to point to, they can say Beijing, look, this is what we are contending with here. It is now in our hand, on our schedule, on our terms to define what we're going to do, because we have this mandate to do what we want to do. And that's not to say that they are going to either chuck out entirely the Trump administration approach or simply apply it and extend it. I think what you're likely to see is, and these are very experienced practitioners who are going to be involved in this relationship, they're going to use the elements of the existing setting of the table in ways that are helpful for them. They don't need to roll back tariffs until something is provided in return. They don't need to simply change course from the existing approach on technology until they see evidence of progress. And so even though there may be, and there are, very deep philosophical disagreements about the approach that the Trump administration took, and how the incoming Biden administration will take it, they are also in the fortunate position of being able to inherit the elements that they find useful and use them as leverage as necessary. So I'll sort of leave it there, because there are, this is, by the way, a thrilling chat with colleagues here. And I just feel like we could do this every day for the next week and not even fulfill all of our mandate here.
Absolutely. I feel exactly the same way. Eric, so one other area where this issue of leverage comes up is, of course, Iran and the JCPOA. And this, if I think you're sketching out potential differences between a Democratic administration of whatever president and a Republican Senate. you know, the JCPOA is probably pretty high up there on the list of areas of difference. Could you speak a little bit about how you think a Biden administration should conceive of this issue, particularly with regard to all the leverage that this Trump administration has bequeathed to them? And is there a way to do this that sort of, you know, builds a bridge to the Senate and a way to do it maybe that burns that bridge?
Great question, Tom. And first, I just want to say I agree with every single word that Evan just said, including and the. I mean, he I think, sketched out brilliantly how I think the Biden folks are going to be looking at the China question. And this goes more broadly, I think, into defense policy because of the national security strategy that the Trump people adopted, which prioritizes competition with Russia and China. And, you know, before the election, the House Armed Services Committee Chairman Adam Smith said that, you know, there was going to be a big fight among Democrats about the defense budget and Biden needed to do a new national defense strategy and all of that. I think they will, of course, do a new national defense strategy, but I don't think it's going to end up quite where Adam Smith thought because of the election returns and for all the reasons that Evan just adduced, which is there is a broad bipartisan consensus that we're in a long-term competition strategically with China and with Russia, and that probably China's the longer-term, bigger challenge. So I think that there's broad acceptance of that, and I think the Biden administration can make its own adjustments and fillips and build on that. And Biden, I think, signaled that in his Stars and Stripes interview where he said he didn't think there were going to be big cuts, you know, in the defense budget, notwithstanding the Sanders amendment that calls for a 10% across the board defense cut. I think he was signaling all of this. On Iran in particular, you know, the vice president said that he wanted to go right back into the Iran nuclear deal. And I hope he doesn't, because I think that would be a huge mistake strategically. And it really speaks to the point that Tammy made earlier about every administration. And I went through five different presidential transitions during my 30-year career. And one thing that occurs all the time is the challenge, because people always come back from having been in, you know, office previously 4 or 8 years ago. And what people discover is that the world has changed. And sometimes it takes them shorter and sometimes it takes them longer to figure that out. And I hope that the Biden team will discover that on Iran, it's changed and that it doesn't take them longer, but shorter, because they've been bequeathed, again, as Evan was suggesting with China, enormous leverage because of the impact that almost nobody predicted, including the critics of the Trump administration, that the maximum pressure campaign would build as much economic pressure on Iran as it has. And the Iranian economy is in terrible shape. Moreover, the Iranians now are very much out of compliance with the standards set in the JCPOA. And so to go back in and relieve the sanctions pressure without getting something pretty considerable in return would be, I think, to squander the leverage that they have. Moreover, it would poison the relationship with Senate Republicans who will be looking at this very carefully, and not just Republicans. Let's not forget that at the time the JCPOA was agreed, I was going to say signed, but then I remember it was never actually signed because it's not a signed agreement. It's just an accord. But the Senate, when it was debating it, never voted on it because the Obama administration refused to have a vote because they knew they would lose. The Senate minority leader, and who hopes to be the Senate majority leader, Chuck Schumer, came out against the agreement. The ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Menendez, came out against the agreement. The next ranking member on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Ben Cardin, came out against the agreement. And so there will be bipartisan folks looking at this to see how much the Biden folks are both using the leverage they've got, but also addressing what even the Democratic platform admits were omissions in the agreement to begin with, which is the ballistic missile program and Iran's malign behavior. So I think the way forward for the Biden administration on this is first to consult with allies and try and develop a common approach to getting Iran to the table to get a better agreement that doesn't allow Republicans to pick at all the weaknesses of the earlier agreement, including things like the conventional arms embargo on Iran that that expired on October 18th while all the rest of this stuff was going on and nobody was noticing. And that, I think, will be the best way forward. If they just rush back in and say, we're going back into the agreement and we don't really care about all the rest of this, I think that it would be both a diplomatic mistake, but I think it'll also envenom relations in the Congress.
Tamar, if I could bring you in on this, and I'd love to get your thoughts on Eric's comments, but also, you know, it's hard to think of another region in the world where maybe Joe Biden's election will be greeted so coolly, maybe at the Middle East. I mean, these guys generally were totally in bed with Trump and pretty supportive of him for a wide variety of reasons. So, you know, on the Iran piece for sure, but also on the broader sort of Middle East challenge that a Biden administration will face. And, you know, this isn't necessarily an area where you want to reassure, and sort of, you know, there are legitimate substantive differences and beefs with several of these leaders, including, of course, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. So how do you think about the choices that a Biden administration will face in the first 6 months, including on the JCPOA?
Yeah, I'm doubtful, Eric, that a Biden administration is going to rush back into a JCPOA that Iran is out of compliance with. I don't actually think that's realistic. I think more likely is the question of whether you can tee up some kind of essentially a freeze for freeze, where the Iranians stop their, especially the enrichment activity that has brought them out of compliance, the stockpiling of nuclear material. And, you know, Elliot Abrams is right now in the region consulting with allies about scaling up Iran sanctions, which, you know, in a way puts the Biden administration in a good position, although I think Abrams' intent is to tie a Biden administration's hands, but it does give them more leverage, at least in the short term, I think, with the Iranians to demand a sort of freeze for freeze. And that gives you time to consult with allies, to sketch out the parameters of what a bigger, longer, stronger JCPOA 2.0 might look like. So, you know, that's the direction I expect that they will take. But I think that as far as the region is concerned, Israel aside, the primary concern with Iran has not been the nuclear proliferation. It has been the other activities. And what we've seen over the course of this maximum pressure with no off-ramp is that Iran has escalated those activities. And the Trump administration's incoherence in responding to that, alternating between bluster and aggression, and, you know, truly leaving allies in the lurch, as the Saudis were after the attack on the Abqaiq refinery facility, it's leaving these allies with a lot of questions about the direction of American policy. And so, you know, I do think this is going to be, it is both a challenge and an opportunity for the United States, but it's going to come up very quickly in a lot of places. This is the issue that is going to bring Riyadh and Abu Dhabi and everybody else knocking on the door, just as it was when the Trump administration came in, by the way. One of the reasons that they went all in for Trump is because they felt fairly or unfairly betrayed and abandoned by an Obama administration that conducted secret diplomacy without telling them with the Iranians and made noises about leaving the Saudis and Iranians to work out their own modus vivendi. So how does Biden put those pieces together? pursue some kind of diplomatic engagement with Iran without creating the perception that I think would be incorrect, but is quite likely among these hypersensitive regional partners, that Biden's just being the anti-Trump and switching sides, you know, back to the Iranians. And of course, there are plenty of Republican critics here in the United States who will jump on that as well. So I think that this is, you know, it would be to his advantage to find a way to sort of kick the nuclear can down the road a little bit and address the allies' immediate concerns about and our immediate concerns about Iran-linked militia activity in Iraq, about the ability to defend against missile attacks and rocket attacks from the Iranians and from their Houthi allies and from Hezbollah. And, you know, to have some really tough and honest conversations with regional partners about the ways in which their behavior over the last 4 years has gone not just beyond the bounds of partnership, but beyond the bounds of basic international norms. The violations of sovereignty of other countries, including the United States, by the Saudis, for example, you know, not only the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, but the planting of spies inside Twitter, you know, the abuse of diplomatic facilities, using Saudi diplomatic facilities to help Saudis in the U.S. who are accused of common crimes escape justice. This is not how friends behave. And so there does need to be some very, very honest conversation about the things we need to do together and the things that that they need to pull back on in order to demonstrate that they're committed to this partnership.
Thank you. Toria, there's a question here from Jennifer Rubin, which is how can President-elect Biden rebuild morale and institutional knowledge at the State Department? So I'd like you to address that, but I'd also like to make a link to what Tamara and Eric were just saying about leverage, because we often hear that the Biden administration ought to use this leverage that has been bequeathed to it. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how it might generate leverage and if there's anything sort of that we've all learned from the Trump administration in terms of, you know, there were occasions where they did generate leverage, even though people didn't necessarily think it would work and they didn't have a strategy necessarily to execute on it or to negotiate on it. But were there things maybe that, you know, the Obama administration could have done more of to generate leverage? What's sort of your thinking on how a Biden administration might be able to create leverage of its own that it can use, you know, over the subsequent 4 years? And I just mean that in terms of we often hear about reinvigorating diplomacy. Diplomacy is personnel, it's resources, it's the buildings. It's also sort of the strategy. And you've got a lot of experience, obviously, in negotiating and with some pretty tough characters. So how do you think about sort of revitalizing diplomacy on across the spectrum of all of those areas?
Well, first of all, you know, I and I think a lot of people subscribe to the adage that diplomacy doesn't work unless it's backed by strength. And that means, as we were talking about before, being increasingly strong at home, recovering fast, but also rebuilding this alliance structure so that regardless of the adversary, whether it's China or Russia or Iran or any force around the world that wants to undercut the liberal world order run by the democratic world, we have to rally together. And that's the greatest leverage when we're working in tandem with others. You know, I was fascinated listening to Eric and Tammy. I think the Middle East is going to be the most complicated for the Biden administration, because I don't think we have an articulation yet of the Middle East end state that we'd like to see. Right? How much does it matter to the United States that Syria is still bleeding, that Libya is still bleeding, that Yemen is a mess, that the Gulfies can't work together, that you know, Israel is aligning with some, but we're not solving, as Tammy made clear, the strategic fundamental threats to Israel from Hezbollah, et cetera. So, you know, I think the question becomes, can you articulate a vision of investment in the Middle East, whether it's with regard to Syria, Iraq, Libya, Yemen, you know, that is perhaps not the lofty 2011, you know, Freedom Spring vision, but is nonetheless a consistent investment on the side of stability, on the side of rolling back malign behavior, whether it's Iran, whether it's Russia, whether it's Saudis, whether it's our ally Turkey, and bringing major allies to the table around that vision. And as Eric and Tammy have said, you know, JCPOA, unlike the climate accord, is not turnkey. You can't just flip it back on because the conditions are no longer being met. So how do you define this bigger, I would say, at the same time that you don't want to see Iran built going back to building nuclear weapons, the malign behavior with the support of other malign actors around the world is more dangerous right now. And how do you build on that? The other thing is with the JCPOA, you know, remember that Russia and China were partners. Hard to imagine that we're going to be able to do that with them. So again, I think this takes you back to your question of leverage, Tom, which is that, you know, with Europe, with our Asian allies, starting with a core of G7 nations who are the biggest democracies around the world, how do you work together both to rebuild ourselves, because you have to start from that Kennan place. Remember, the Long Telegram speaks about you can't defeat the Soviet Union if you're not strong at home, which, you know, Reagan also took up with a vengeance in 1980, and I think will be persuasive to congressional Republicans if it's articulated right. But how do you convince everybody to make a contribution in common? And frankly, I don't see another country that can organize this joint liberal approach to China, to Russia, to technology, to Iran, to climate, other than us. So we're going to have to first articulate a clear vision. We're going to have a team that can implement it. I mean, one of the main problems at stake was that they weren't doing any diplomacy. They weren't conducting any negotiations. You know, Pompeo went out and did a little bit, but a State Department that is working, as Eric taught me, has 10 major policy leaders from the secretary, deputy secretary, undersecretary for political affairs, all the regional assistant secretaries, and even some ambassadors who are out engaging in negotiations and who are supported by young diplomatic teams who are learning how it's done, who are working with the Evans of this world to explain policy to the Fourth Estate, who are in dialogue with the Congress, and who are bringing resources to the table, whether there are security resources, whether they are development resources, whether they are, you know, the punitive resources of a shared sanctions approach, et cetera. So, you know, we have not been out there in the world. The table has been empty, and the malign actors, whoever they are, have rushed in to fill the gap, and they've had it easy. But also our allies have had it easy because we haven't been asking them to join with us in some of these things. And some of them may be very difficult, including things like if we decide that we need to have an export control regime together against Chinese high technology, which I think is a bipartisan move that people will support. Will the Europeans support that? Will our Asian allies support that? So there's a lot of work to do. But I think it will be exciting for the State Department to get back into the business of trying to talk to allies and friends and adversaries about all this work that needs to be done.
Tom, can I just pick up on some of what Toria said? Because I don't disagree with what she said, but I think it is very hard to underestimate how much damage has been done to the diplomatic platform of the United States by the Trump administration. And it's not just the Trump administration. There were a number of trends that go back way before that that have contributed to this. But the hemorrhage of senior officers, Toria being, you know, I think a typical example. I mean, my age cohort, I'm 69, you know, we aged out. And so that's not important that people of my age group left. But the problem is American taxpayers have invested enormous amounts of money getting people in Toria's age cohort ready to assume the most senior positions, and they're not there now. There's just a giant void. And you can't make that up by just saying, well, we're going to promote the 40 and 45-year-olds, because this is a business where experience long development of subject matter expertise and familiarity actually means a lot. It matters dramatically. So I think the State Department is going to require really a kind of 10 to 15 year rebuild. I mean, when Toria and I entered the Foreign Service, there were roughly 22,000 people a year taking the Foreign Service exam. Last year, it was 7,000. There is going to have to be a lot of work done and a lot of effort. I think probably, the last time the Foreign Service got looked at by the legislative branch was in 1980 with the Foreign Service Act of 1980. It's probably time to review that and have a new Foreign Service Act. There are new core competencies that are going to be required. This is an opportunity, I guess, because of how badly the institution was burned down, to actually reimagine it and rebuild it in a way that serves the U.S. national interest. But I think no one should underestimate the length of time or the amount of effort it's going to take.
Thank you, Eric. Very, very important issue. And I know everyone, I think, has views on this, but we have 10 minutes left. And I just wanted to turn quickly to several questions, Evan on and Tamara on the transition. So John Rash at the Minneapolis Star Tribune asked how diplomatically damaging is President Trump's refusal to concede and to continue contesting the election, the election results. There is another question from Deirdre She's Green of USA Today about which foreign leaders will President-elect Biden speak to in the coming days and what are those conversations likely to be about. But I guess the overarching question is really this fairly unprecedented situation of a 78-day transition with a outgoing president that seems sort of determined to, if not quite burn everything to the ground, maybe to push back, not to cooperate in the transfer of power and to sort of build up his political position in the future. Evan, could you just talk to us a little bit maybe about the dangers of what's going on at the moment? How rocky are the next couple of months likely to be? How's the Biden team likely to respond? But more importantly, really, is there any sort of long-term damage that could be done over the next sort of 2.5 months that wouldn't be easily repaired? Not so much on the policy side, but rather on the, on the institutions of government and the health of American democracy.
Yeah, I think it's impossible to overstate how damaging it is to the short, medium, and long-range interests of the United States to have a president who appears to be fundamentally rejecting the legitimacy of our political system. And it's damaging to the interests of the Republican Party as a foreign policy actor. It's damaging to the interests of the American public. And of course, it makes it more challenging for the Biden administration that's coming in. And I think what you've seen is the Biden administration, the Biden campaign knew exactly what Donald Trump was going to do. This was not a mystery. It's one of those weird things that's both shocking and unsurprising. And their approach has been now quite consistent over the last few days. And I think you'll see it continue, which is they will not allow themselves to be drawn in to the invention of a dispute. There is no dispute here. The law is clear. The votes are being counted and the count is clear. And the only confusion here, frankly, is in the mind of Donald J. Trump and on the part of the leaders around him who are deciding in real time whether or not to acknowledge reality or to make the political calculation to stay in his particular form of delusion. And I have to be honest, I'm being blunt about this because those are the stakes here. And I think the way to think of it is that the Biden campaign is practicing what I would call sort of vigilant reassurance. They're letting the world know that they are not participating in the fiction that there is an actual dispute, but they are also using the courts as absolutely aggressively as they need to be. But they don't have any question here. On January 20th, President Trump's signature becomes legally inoperative. The next president will take office. full stop.
Yeah, so let me come in on that. I do think, you know, the lost time for a transition team in getting cooperation from the current administration matters, although that is not unprecedented. Bush v. Gore was decided on December 12th, and there was an orderly transition between then and January 20th. So it's doable, but it seems that so far the Trump administration has instructed agency heads not to cooperate with the incoming team. So the transition landing teams cannot start their work. The transition can prepare personnel choices, but it's going to have a lot of trouble getting those people into the nomination process if the Republican Senate is not willing to go along with the transition. So the lost time does matter. But I actually think that there are a couple other things that worry me more in this transition period. One is that it is always a part of transition planning to be concerned about which international actors might try to take advantage of the transition period to test the United States or to undertake activities where they might otherwise face challenges from the US. And given Trump's capriciousness, irrationality, incoherence, the lack of a policy process, that's a more dangerous prospect for the United States in this transition than in any previous one. We just don't know how he would react for example, another major Iraqi militia attack on American troops or the American embassy in Iraq, just to take one example. So we have to worry about that. The other thing that worries me very much is what will be left behind and what will be destroyed. We have plenty of evidence now of the corruption of the Trump administration's and its willingness to use foreign policy and international relationships for private purposes and private gain. Whether we're talking about the issue that was litigated in the impeachment of the president or the simple use of the State Department in, you know, dinners for Mike Pompeo and his wife to prepare the political ground for, you know, his possible electoral future. That kind of corruption is corrosive. So even when you remove the elected and appointed officials of the Trump administration, you have layers and layers of people in the State Department and in every agency across the federal government who have been coerced into these acts of corruption. They've simply been complicit or in an attempt to defend their agency from worse depredations went along with them because they had to pick their battles. All of the bitterness, the recrimination, and the corrosion of that experience is left behind for a Biden administration to confront. And that will impede our ability to do our work. So I think that's a tremendous challenge that we can't lose sight of.
Thank you. Is there anyone want to come in on that point before I move on?
I would just, first of all, I agree with, you know, everything Evan and Tammy just said. I do want to make one point, which is, you know, look, if Emily Murphy designates, President Biden as President-elect Biden as President-elect on December 14th, when the electors are certified, as Tammy said, that won't be any, you know, later than the
Clinton Bush v. Gore.
Bush transition. But I have to say, and I think that from my conversations, the Biden transition folks have been anticipating an uncooperative transition from the outset, as Evan suggested. Having said that, you know, to the point that Tammy made earlier, that when people get in, they need to take an assessment of the state of the agencies as they are, and prepare, you know, for taking the reins of government on January 21st. And our system is not like the British system where you have the election and then, you know, the new prime minister walks into number 10 and gets handed his red box with all of the memos by the permanent cabinet secretary who continues in office and everything just kicks over. I mean, if you actually want to watch the transition of power, you know, you can go to the Southwest Gate, or at least as close as you can get to it nowadays, and watch the 18-wheelers pulling out of West Exec Avenue with all the records of the previous administration, and new administrations come into the White House, you know, and there's nothing there except maybe a couple of secretaries and some phones that might or might not work. So the problem is that, as one of my former Foreign Service mentors told me long ago, transition time is equal to 3 times governing time. Because when you walk in there on January 21st, you are literally drinking from the fire hose. There is everything from around the world pouring in at you and demanding attention and a response. And so the ability to try and think through these problems that you're going to inherit calmly and without being forced to take immediate action on them is a luxury that we have in our system that we're squandering. And it's going to complicate everything. And it's one reason why it's such a disgrace that more Republicans have not spoken out, as Mitt Romney has and a few others, to call an end to this charade.
Thank you, Eric. We're out of time, actually. So I'd like to give Toria the last word, maybe on either on the transition point or on anything else that you'd like to add before we close.
You know, I agree with all that's been said. I think this team will be supremely prepared. I think the bigger problem, and it's not just Trump intransigence, it's also COVID, which makes it hard to gather and speak informally and get the wisdom of the long-serving professional staffs in all of these agencies. It will be harder. But I'm an optimist. I think Joe Biden's an optimist. I think the world is ready for a more orderly and stable and predictable and committed United States. So I look forward to it.
Toria, Evan, Eric, Tamara, thank you so much. Thank you all of you online for joining us via Zoom and via the website. I think we had a very large number of people. So thank you so much. And thank you also for the questions. And I can say with great confidence that this is an issue we will come back to, Evan, maybe not every day or every other day, but probably every week for now, for some time to come. So thank you again. And until the next time, we are adjourned. Thank you.